I need to tell you that the disappearing flowers from last Sunday were supposed to be here to honor the birth of Jordan Chandler Gaetjes have appeared this week. And Colette and Ron had looked forward to being here at the same time, but the little guy has pink eye, so nobody came. You can tell Colette and Ron that the flowers were pretty. When he wrote a small new Christian church in what is now Turkey, the Apostle Paul listed 9 personality traits that should grow stronger in the lives of people trying to imitate Christ. Things like patience, kindness, humility. And we come this morning to the last one in that list. My wife, who sings in the choir, having heard me struggle for the past 8 weeks with these abstract virtues, because I found them rather difficult to work with, threatened to say when I came to this moment, "Hallelujah!" Anyway, we are at the end of the list. And the last word is self-control. The ability to impose self-discipline upon our lives. The book of Proverbs, which is a textbook for Jewish children, is filled with comments like this one. If you lack self-control, you are like a city whose walls have been knocked down, open to invasion. And this one, it's better to have self-control than to control an army. I can imagine some ancient professor saying to his class, a general who can control his men, but not himself, sooner or later will lose their respect. Most of us have played on teams. We know what players think of a coach who insists that they keep themselves under control, but cannot do that for himself. The first thing we think about when we hear the word self-control is temper. And temper triumphs over logic so often that we feel a little sympathy with a young man I read about last week. During a bus strike in his town, he walked home from work one evening through a park. He was alone. It was getting late. And in the middle of his trek, he saw someone walking toward him on the narrow little path. His first reaction, given the current state of things, was a spasm of fear. So at the last second, he moved to make a little more space, but the stranger did the same thing. And since each one stepped left, they bumped into each other. It made the young man angry, and a few minutes later, he decided it probably wasn't an accident and felt for his wallet. It was gone. He really blew up, raced back to the pickpocket and said, "Give me the wallet." And the man handed the wallet over without a word. And when our guy got home, the first thing he saw was his wallet lying on the bed where he had left it. There was no way to avoid the embarrassing truth. He had mugged somebody. It isn't easy to talk about temper because, like a fine sword, we have to have some of it to be useful. A brilliant English philosopher argues that people who are uncommonly placid, people like myself, if you need an example, and have what he calls softness of temper very seldom rise to greatness. Temper is fueled by passionate conviction, and if the conviction is wise and unselfish, the passion can create great leaders. We were all remembering General Eisenhower last week, and I recall the day he came to my outfit. And I can tell you something. His smile was famously genial. But when it was called for, his temper could scorch the earth. People who care greatly have to work harder than others to keep temper under control. Most of the time, Ike used his passion to hold quarreling factions together, to keep junior officers on their toes, to benefit the troops who would risk their lives if they failed to train properly. Most of the time, he did that. But then, we estimate a life on what is true most of the time. And Ike is deservedly beloved. It's easier, of course, for some to control temper than it is for others. People in public life run into far more temptations than those who live quietly in obscure places. It doesn't surprise me to read that our current president, whose tears on certain occasions I believe to be genuine, also has on other occasions an explosive temper. He has to work harder on self-control, I realize, than my Uncle Kate, who loved everybody all the time with the constant help of his favorite malt beverage. The test of character is not whether we have temper, but what causes us to lose it. If we lose it over trivia, if we lose it often, if we lose it because of vanity, we give up all chance of effective leadership or influence. We excuse ourselves, of course, by saying we can't help it. But more often than not, we really could, if we wanted to badly enough. A little boy just the other day was mad at his mother and sassy. She said, "Do you ever lose your temper like this at school?" "No." "Why not?" "Well, because," he said, "I don't want the teacher not to like me." In other words, he could presume on the love of his mother, expecting her to like him no matter how he behaves, but because he has to work at holding the affection of his teacher, he keeps himself under control. This is why husbands and wives sometimes act so much better before marriage than they do afterwards, when they begin to take one another's love and respect for granted. The simple truth is that if we couldn't control ourselves at all, there would be no point in a scripture that says, "Be slow to get angry," and another that says, "Make every effort to practice self-control." I know there can be some improvement. I used to type fast letters in moments of warm reaction and mail them within the hour. This is a great mistake. Now, if I write that kind of letter, I put it away for a day or so, reread it, and then invariably either revise it or throw it away. Improvement is possible. But this is more about temper than I had intended. Self-control involves more than just the handling of temper. Given the will and a lot of practice, we can change all sorts of attitudes in ourselves. I like the true story of a certain woman who kept seeing her doctor with a whole catalog of complaints about her health. He examined her thoroughly and became convinced that there was nothing physically wrong, that her negative outlook was the key to her misery. So one day he pointed to some empty bottles on a nearby shelf and said, "I can take one of those bottles and fill it with poison, enough to kill a person, or I can fill it with good medicine that stops a fever, a headache, fights bacteria, saves a life. I need to tell you that you have the same power over your life. You can choose to fill it with life-affirming thoughts, or you can fill it with thoughts that are bitter and envious and destructive. The choice is yours, and you are your own doctor. Good luck." In his own way, he was saying to her what I heard a speaker say recently to an audience: "Do you want to know the person whom you have most reason to protect yourself against? Look in the mirror." Martin Luther, a passionate man of great strengths and equally great weaknesses, understood that quite well. In the midst of his dangerous confrontations with the Catholic Church, he said, "I am more afraid of my own heart than of the Pope and all his cardinals. I have within me the great Pope, self." In the privacy of our own hearts, we struggle all our lives for self-control. But things get out of control in public affairs as well. And I want to talk for a moment about a malaise in American life which we need to bring under control, although I'm not quite sure how to do it. We have an enormous and insatiable appetite for trash, to which much of the media predictably pander in the interests of profit, and profit is legitimate. I have edited a daily newspaper. TV and radio and the print industry understand markets. They know that we have not yet said loudly and firmly enough that we are sick of what a recent New Yorker essay calls indecent exposure. Now, I don't mean the kind of investigation that indicts Republican Ollie North or Democrat Dan Rostenkowski for breaking the law. I mean specifically our prurient appetite for details about the intimate, private lives of public people, our apparent willingness to tolerate the broadcasting of the most personal and embarrassing tales of bedroom or bathhouse. There is a climate of incivility and unfairness which both major political parties have used with so much unholy joy that they have created in a great many of us a deep sense of disgust. It does not seem to matter ultimately which party is in power. The political dialogue is more and more debased, and those who lead the parties set up special units to see what dirt they can dig up on each other. Some Democrats have done it. Some Republicans are doing it now, and the media feels obligated to record every below-the-belt punch. I think no one writes more thoughtfully about the American scene than Daniel Shore, who said this the other day about our preoccupation with trash. If D-Day happened today, the news probably would read something like this. General Dwight D. Eisenhower, rumored to be having an affair with his British chauffeur, led an Allied invasion of Normandy today. Pentagon spokesman denied speculation that the action was timed to distract attention from persistent rumors about General Eisenhower's personal life. Now, the media could have crippled Ike at a crucial time, but chose to concentrate on matters of more legitimate public interest. World War II correspondent people kept Ike's relationship with his driver, Kay Summersby, out of the news, as Washington reporters did about Roosevelt and Lucy, and as they would do later about John Kennedy's own private life. Perhaps there was some regard for the feelings of wives and children. Nowadays, affairs do not even have to be confirmed to be reported. It seemed highly dubious to me back in 92 that George Bush was involved with several women, as tabloids said, and other newspapers and magazines felt obliged for competition's sake to pick up. If Democrats were behind that, they deserve contempt, just as Republicans deserve it now if they go mucking about to dredge up every piece of nasty gossip they can find about Bill Clinton. What a strange culture we have created, by the way, when teenage girls ask the President of the United States on MTV what kind of undershorts he prefers. Mr. Clinton was too nice to them. He should have said, "Young ladies, that is none of your business." I thought, when we were being treated to the sordid charges and countercharges of Professor Anita Hill and Judge Clarence Thomas, that at least we couldn't sink any lower than that, only to have a media frenzy over Paula Jones prove me wrong. We are cheapened by such publicity, and we are less well governed because of it. I could hardly believe my eyes a day or so ago when I read that evangelist Jerry Falwell is selling videotapes in which a man accuses the president of being involved in numerous murders. And since Hillary Rodham Clinton's agenda is not to Reverend Falwell's liking, the tape also has undocumented charges that she, too, has been guilty of a wide variety of sexual indiscretions. The good reverend is carefully not claiming himself that the charges are true, only that they should be looked into by the media. He knows, of course, what airing such a story does to damage people in public life, even if it is ultimately exposed as a lie, not on page one, usually, since it isn't exciting anymore, but on page 16, bottom left, just above the ads for summer t-shirts. Civility, good manners, simple courtesy has taken a terrific beating in the last few years. Jimmy Carter, in my opinion, was not an effective president. But after his defeat, his Habitat for Humanity involvement and his efforts in behalf of peace and human dignity around the world have certainly made him one of the most admired ex-presidents in our history. It is a sad commentary on what Americans will tolerate, even like, when the most popular talk show on radio discussing the crisis in North Korea drops the level of political discourse well below the gutter by sneering, "Well, all we need to do is to send Jimmy Carter over to Korea. He could sip a cup of tea with them and build them some cheap houses." And millions of people who, like the speaker, profess Christianity, laugh. Now, you will miss the point entirely this morning if you worry about whether I am Republican, Democratic, or Libertarian. Christianity stands in judgment on me, on institutions, on all political parties. And what I want to say is that unless we bring our appetite for trash talk and sordid gossip under control, we will discourage highly capable men and women from aspiring to lead us, and we will end up with incompetents who may talk very piously, but are incompetent, and who, I can promise you, will in turn be crippled by their own private faults if we choose to exploit them. Now, if Christianity is still a power in this country, we and Mr. Falwell might pay some attention to the advice of its greatest apostle. Listen. First of all, I urge that prayers and thanksgiving be made for everyone, for kings and all who are in high position, so that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and dignity. Dignity. What a nice word. Ready for every good work, showing courtesy to those around us. In public life, we seem not exactly headed in that direction. And if you have an answer to our dilemma, please let me hear it.